Welcome to Vicom's weekly podcast. My name is James Green, Vicom CEO. I'm delighted to be joined by Vicom fellow Brigadier General Michael Herzog. Welcome, Mike, to the podcast.
Thanks. Happy to be on the podcast.
Thank you. So there are two issues that I really wanted to talk to you about relate to the report that you wrote last week for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Iran across the border, Israel's pushback in Syria, which I would advise anyone interested in what's been going on with Iranian forces in Syria and all the wider issues with Russia, Iran, the US, etc. Do have a look at that report. But really, I wanted to start by asking you about the stories that we read in Al-Sharq al-Assad earlier this week about two strikes allegedly by Israeli forces against pro-Iranian militias and Iranian personnel in Iraq. And just to give our listeners the detail, there was a report this week and they talked about two attacks, one on the 19th of July at a base in Amreli in Saladin province, used by a pro-Iranian militia called the Hashd al-Shaabi, which is also called the Popular Mobilization Forces. Apparently, there were Iranian missiles that were supplied to that militia, and allegedly Israel destroyed those. And also in another story, Al-Sharq al-Assad talked about a strike on the 28th of July, where they say Israeli forces attacked a base in Ashraf, which is northeast of Baghdad. And in that attack, Iranian advisors, personnel, and also Hezbollah fighters were allegedly killed. And really, Mike, I just wanted to start off by talking about this, because you say in your report, Iran across the border, and you talk about how there is this process going on where Iran is supplying missiles to these Shia militias. And these are not really missiles that are sort of short-range missiles that you'd expect to be used within the context of fighting in Iraq. We're talking about three types of missiles. They're called the Zelzal, the Fateh, and the Zulfikar, which have a range of between 210 to 700 kilometers. So I suppose the question our listeners will be asking is, why on earth does a pro-Iranian militia need a 700-kilometer ballistic missile?
According to media reports, what was attacked in Iraq are facilities or military bases of Iranian proxies with storage facilities for missiles and parts of missiles. And if these reports are accurate, it would indicate to me that Israel is expanding its campaign against the Iranian ambitious plans in its neighborhood to entrench itself militarily, and especially against the so-called precision project, an Iranian project designed to provide Hezbollah and other Iranian proxies with a significant arsenal of highly accurate rockets. Now, to provide a wider background, as I write in my paper, Iran launched, beginning in 2016, a very ambitious plan to fill the void created by years of war and turmoil in the Middle East, and create a zone of direct influence stretching from Iran to the Mediterranean. And an important part of this plan was to build Syria as a formidable military front against Israel, including Iranian forces, proxy forces, planes, drones, defense industries, and last but not least, the so-called precision rockets, namely facilities designed to convert parts of Hezbollah's arsenal of rockets into a highly precise one, which would pose a significant challenge to Israel in times of war. Israel has targeted these facilities in Syria, and as a result, Iran decided to move critical components of the precision project from Syria to either Lebanon or Iraq. In Lebanon, there are some underground facilities dealing with this conversion. And in Iraq, according to available information, Iran provided its Shiite proxies with a small number of highly accurate rockets with a range to reach Israel from western Iraq, namely over 700 kilometers of the types you just mentioned earlier. Not only that, but according to available information, Iran also established facilities in those military bases for storage of these missiles and their components, so they can serve as kind of a way stations that could be used in times of need or war to send the accurate missiles to Syria and to Lebanon.
So just to be clear and to ask the question, so you're saying categorically that your understanding is that these are not missiles being provided to these militias for their own use within their own conflicts. It's absolutely your understanding that they're being provided to these militias in order that they can sort of be there as an attack option for Iran, whether it be against Israel or other countries, but it's specifically as a kind of attack option outside of Iraq.
I'm saying both things.
Right.
Iran is providing its Shiite proxies in Iraq with these missiles, so they can be used against Israel from Iraq in times of war, and that's part of a broader concept, Iranian concept, so that in times of war, Israel will face numerous fronts from Lebanon, from Syria, from Iraq, and from Gaza. So these proxies have missiles which they can fire on Israel. At the very same time, it appears that what Iran is doing is building a way station to provide accurate missiles to its proxies in Syria and Lebanon as well. So we'll face them from all fronts, as I noted. This could provide the context and explanation to what has happened. Again, if these media reports are right, to me, they indicate that Israel is expanding its campaign against the Iranian designs beyond Lebanon and Syria and also to parts of Iraq.
And how much more difficult is it for Israel to attack these sites in Iraq? I mean, you know, you say in your paper and you set out in great detail about how ambitious and potentially how successful the campaign's been against Iranian attempts to do this in Syria. They're moving them now into Iraq. So how much more difficult is it for Israel to operate in Iraq? Is it the intelligence on the ground? Is it the fact that Iraq is more complex? Is it the fact that there are US forces there? Is it all of the above?
It's all of the above. Iraq is, of course, more far away than Syria or Lebanon. Even though Israel has the capacity to fly there and strike, but the farther you go, the less precise intelligence you may have. And also, there is this complexity of American forces in Iraq. And the possibility that if Iran seeks to answer such strikes, it may also target Americans. I think the Iranians will not rush to target Americans directly, but I cannot rule out that under certain circumstances they will do so. So that provides another complication. I assume that this is part of the reason why Iran moved some of its some elements of the project to Iraq, assuming it'll be more complicated for Israel. But again, assuming these media reports are correct, it tells us that Israel nevertheless decided to meet the challenge and strike there again.
Yeah. And just going on to your report about Syria, which, if I may say, is a very good kind of overview of, you know, what has Israel been trying to achieve against Iranian forces since 2016. You seem to conclude in the paper that the Israeli operations have been relatively successful in that they've prevented Iran from achieving its military objectives. What do you want to expand on that a bit?
Yeah. Since early 2017, Israel decided to launch a campaign to push back on the Iranian designs and capabilities in Syria. This was initiated and commanded by Israel's then Chief of Staff, General Eisenkot, and the idea was to not to allow Iran to develop Syria into a military front it wanted to. And Israel carried out what in Israeli terms is called the campaign between the wars, namely a campaign in the gray zone between doing nothing and going to war. But the idea was to push back in a way that prevents war, does not exacerbate war, but does not expedite war, but prevents war. According to media reports, since early 2017, Israel carried out hundreds of strikes against targets belonging to Iran and its proxies in Syria, and did not escalate to war, and it has been relatively successful. If you compare the Iranian initial plans where they are today, you'll see a huge gap. The Iranians wanted to deploy significant Iranian forces. They scaled down. They had designs to deploy in Syria a proxy army of up to 100,000 people, including a new Syrian Hezbollah, like the Lebanese one. And they are far away from that. They wanted to deploy Iranian planes in Syrian military bases. They have not. They deployed drones. Most of them were destroyed. They wanted wharves in Syrian ports. They did not get them, mainly because of Russia, not only because of Israel. They established a series of intelligence facilities facing Israel in southern Syria. All of them have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. So if you compare what their initial plans were and where they are today, and of course, on top of that, they created facilities for converting Hezbollah's arsenal of dumb rockets into accurate ones, and most of them were targeted. So they are far away from their original designs. That being said, it's clear that Iran did not give up on its ambitions, and it's pushing forward, but in an adjusted manner. Namely, they try to distance capabilities away from Israel, northern Syria or eastern Syria, or on the border between Syria and Iraq. They move critical elements of the precision projects to Lebanon and Iraq. They are less centralized. Rather than concentrating capabilities in huge military complexes, they are more decentralized. They try to hide, to the extent possible, behind the so-called cloak of Syrian state legitimacy. In some cases, you have Hezbollah activists wearing Syrian uniform close to our border, and so on and so forth. So the game is not over, and there's certainly potential for escalation. But if you take a perspective of over 2.5 years of an Israeli campaign, I think you can rate it as a success because Israel managed to thwart most of Iran's plans without escalating war. That tells you something about the potential for running a campaign against Iran in the gray zone.
Yeah. And in the paper, you talk about the options to try and sort of peel Russia away from this trilateral partnership with Syria and Iran, and what the gaps are between Russia and Iran, and about how there were various attempts to try and have the US and Israel succeed in some of its objectives by appealing to sort of Russian interests, and for them to understand that, you know, what Iran was trying to do was very much against what Russia wanted to achieve. How successful do you think that's been? And is there more to come from that objective?
When it comes to Russia, it's more of a mixed balance. On the one, I think Israel was correct in assessing both converging and diverging interests between Russia and Iran. It's clear that Russia and Iran fought side by side to save Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and that Russia still needs Iran in certain ways in Syria and beyond. But at the same time, it is also clear that Russia does not want Iran to turn Syria into an Iranian protectorate, does not want Iran to dictate the agenda or undermine Russian designs for a political outcome in Syria and for Western and other investment in the reconstruction of Syria. Russia doesn't want Iran to drag Syria into war with Israel. So Israel has been skillfully playing within these gaps. And as I write in the paper, the basic understandings which were established over time between Israel and Russia were that Israel had, Russia it's made the point that it's not going to push Iran out of Syria militarily. It can curb some of its plans, designs, and ambitions, which it did, for example, when it came to controlling a port or a wharf on the Mediterranean. But beyond what Russia was willing or capable of doing to stop Iran, it allowed Israel free hand. And Israel, as I said, carried out hundreds of strikes. And in the overwhelming majority of the cases, Russia said nothing, much to the frustration of the Iranians. There was an attempt recently to get Russia and the U.S. together, and we had an unprecedented meeting of heads of national security councils of Israel, Russia, and the United States in Jerusalem. And the idea was to play on these Russian-Iranian divergences and perhaps encourage Russia to do more, push Iran out of Syria militarily. I'm not sure that this really succeeded because Russia has its own limitations, and I'm not sure they would go along with pushing Iran out of Syria. And they keep saying that if you want us to do this, then we need some leverage. And leverage in their mind is the U.S. easing sanctions on Iran, which is not happening. Quite the contrary, we see more pressure on Iran. So, but at the same time, I think the understandings between Israel and Russia are there. They allow Israel freedom of action and freedom of maneuver as long as Israel does not endanger Russian forces, personnel, or assets. As long as we are careful about that, I think the Russians kind of play between Israel and Iran in Syria.
Okay, thank you. My final question I wanted to ask was just about your conclusion, I suppose, in the report, where you talk about, interestingly, just how important the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, CODS force, is absolutely crucial to what Iran is trying to do outside of Iran, and that it's very independent. It's the only force that's kind of sustaining all these proxy armies like Hezbollah and others. And you talk about the need to have a sustained kind of united front against the Quds force, not just Israel, but also the US, Europeans and others. How likely do you think that is? And what do you think the key parts of that united front could be? Are we just talking about sanctions, or are we also talking about military options?
The point I'm making is that when you look at Iran as a system, you see a rather weak military. I'm talking about the regular army, army with outdated planes and other war machines. You see a state under very heavy pressure of sanctions and political pressure as a whole. And this general picture, there's one, let's say, island of functionality, which is the IRGC's Quds Force. I'm not talking about the whole of the IRGC, but I'm talking about the Quds Force, which is the Iranian arm to implement and advance Iranian interest outside the borders of Iran itself. So if we're talking about the Lebanon file, the Syria file, the Iraq file, the Yemen file, they are all controlled and run by the Quds Force with the blessing of the supreme leader. They should be the address for any pushback against them. And the point I'm making is that what we need is a concerted campaign with like-minded partners joining hands in running this campaign against the Quds Force, and that could go a long way to curbing Iran's ambitions in the region. And that campaign is not only a military campaign, it's a comprehensive campaign incorporating all sorts of measures, diplomatic pressures, including the UN, economic pressures, cyber activities, kinetic pressures, covert and overt activities, and many other types of things that could be done. Right now, I do not see much appetite in either Europe or the United States to join in such a campaign. I see more appetite in our region. Here, there are some actors concerned about Iran and would be willing to be part of such a campaign. But I would like to see the United States lead such a campaign. And again, it's not necessarily a military campaign or mostly military campaign. There are many other elements to such a campaign, but you have to design a campaign and launch it. Israel has been doing it on its own. But what I'm suggesting is that others join hands and run such a campaign in the region as a whole.
Right. No, understood. Mike, we will leave it there. But I want to just thank you so much for your time today and for your fascinating insights. And do commend that people read the report, Iran Across the Border, Israel's Pushback in Syria, which is on the Washington Institute for Near East Policy website. And we'll be tweeting as well about this podcast. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Next week, we'll be back with analysis on the latest developments in the Israeli election campaign. Remember, there's an election on the 17th of September, and all the parties have to submit their lists by the end of this week. If you liked our podcast, if you are continuing to listen to it, then please do review us on iTunes or whatever app that you use to listen to the podcast. And also feel free to send us any comments at info@bicom.org.uk, and also follow us at Britain Israel. Let us know what you think. Thank you for listening.